Two drinks instead of one, yeah.
My name is DeAndre, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, good morning. Or good afternoon, rather. Wow. I love AA. My sobriety birthday is May the 29th, 1991. My home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag on Monday night, 8:30. And my sponsor is Jimmy Moss. He's sitting way in the back in death row. I don't blame him. He definitely does not want what I have. Trying to get rid of it, I guess. Welcome to the new people. What a great day. It's beautiful outside. The sun is out. And my landlord was over on the property this morning, standing in front of an empty unit. And we were talking and having fun and telling jokes and laughing. And boy, is that different. That's change for me, for this alcoholic. Lauren, Mighty Princess Lauren, is leading the meeting. That's beautiful. One of my friends in sobriety. Congratulations to both Paul and Ethan and AA for those cakes. Beautiful being a part of those two gentlemen's lives. When I see those guys standing there together, it reminds me of consistency. And that's one of the things that I just really couldn't get a hold of when I was a newcomer. And I started drinking when I was around 13 and a half, 14 years old. I used to drink a lot at these parties my mother would give. My mother had a party for every month of the year, for like holidays and whatnot, and then she had six kids, so it's like she could get a party in each month for those children, and then she would just start making shit up, like Flag Day, and have a Flag Day party, you know, and I loved drinking, and my mother made alcoholic fun, and I loved drinking, and the first time I got drunk, I don't remember, who cares, I know it felt good, you know. And that's probably why I kept doing it. And I loved the way, something about alcohol, this feeling that I got when I drank, it made me feel complete. Drugs never did that for me, you know, but alcohol did, you know. Alcohol made me feel like a complete person. And I would drink at those parties and we would dance a lot. And I became the dancing queen, boy. When you get your drunk, man, I can do those dance moves like Michael Jackson and James Brown and Prince. And, you know, I become a choreographer. Around that time, the television series Fame was out, that movie Fame, and everybody was an artist. And we drink and become performers and artists. See a lot of striving artists in AA today. It reminds me of when I used to drink. Everybody's going to be on stage. Everybody's got a stage name and a handle. And, my name is DeAndre, and I'm an alcoholic, man. And I love the adrenaline that I get from drinking. A lot of people drink and they sort of, you know, get relaxed and calm down. Drinking gives me a certain boost. You know, I don't need no damn energy drink. You know, when I'm drinking and I'm getting loaded, man, for some reason I get this urge to drink more. And part of the insanity of that life is that it just seems so right. You know, what could be wrong? You know, why is it not okay to drink all damn day? What is the problem? You can tell that the first people who probably started having a problem with drinking is people who don't drink the way we do. You know? Because I loved it, man. And I remember just challenging people in my little community that drank and partied and whatnot. We would sort of challenge each other to see who could drink the longest or the most. I mean, that would be like our main role for the evening. You know, a lot of people would be trying to get something done with their life. I remember being up all night with some friends, and one of my friends said, man, I got to go to work. Another guy said, man, I got to go, my girlfriend, I got to go get the kids to take them to school. And I wake up and I said, man, I got to get a drink. And that sort of separates me from these people that process alcohol differently, you know. And it went on like that for a long time for me. I remember just living in Watts, and I come from the Jordan Downs housing project. I lived in that community for 14 and a half years, you know, and it's just kind of like one problem right next to another, you know. And that's how I organized my life without this program. I stack my problems right next to each other, so they're so just, you know, just right there to where they're easy enough not to solve. And just live in the problem and do that kind of stuff. And so what happened is I started going to school in the San Fernando Valley. They started busing us out of there. That explains the proper diction when I speak. But I really am from what? You know, I really am from there. Because as you look at me, are you sure you're from what? Yeah, I'm from what? And they bust us out of there. I rode the school bus for 6 years, you know. And they took us out of that community and sent us over the hill. And I just remember hanging out with people that really could get drunk fast. Something about young white people, they can get a hold of that alcohol in their drugs. I mean, they just get instantly. And I love that, you know, I love that. Hanging out with those young white people and getting loaded. And then I'd go home and my mother would be like, what in the hell is wrong with you? And then they had the late bus program. Kind of like an early, like a junior alcoholic booster club or something. You know? So you can go on the bus for regular hours, but then you can catch the late bus. You know, and you know how we are when it comes to being late, you know. We make late look great, don't we? And I remember, you know, getting on that late bus after being loaded on that campus and just coming home and looking at my family and looking at Watts and looking at those projects and looking around going, these people don't really know what it's all about. These people don't have a clue. You know. And that's what started my personal escape or withdrawal from regular old life, no matter where I'm at trying to live, is that these people don't get it, man. You know, my mother struggled financially, emotionally, and spiritually for a long time. And I would think to myself, damn, if she would just drink a little more and keep a little bit more weed around here, she wouldn't have so many damn problems, you know. And that's the way I looked at stuff, for real. You know, I'm not trying to be funny. But my life before this program was a goddamn joke. And I remember just trying to fit into a situation, not inside of me, but inside of out there, where I could be able to get loaded, mind my own damn business, and figure out how to stay that way for the rest of my life. And that's what I cared about. And I remember just having these talks with my friends, and we would envision owning like a home where we could have like a machine that could just pump in that outside issue, and we could just sort of just inhale that and drink wine all day and just live it up. You know, and we really believed that stuff. And so what happened is I started getting to a point where I needed to do more faster, and I didn't have time to do anything in between that, which is why it was a good idea for me to drop out of high school. Because if you do go to school and you have this disease and it's not being treated, school just gets in the way. I mean, there's a lot of things that you could do to be resourceful to keep killing yourself on the installment plan, and having a decent education and being employable is just not the thing that I need to be doing. you know. And so I went ahead and scrapped those ideas, and my mother didn't like that. She threw me out of the house when I was 17 years old and told me that, you know, I'm not going to let you hurt me and this family anymore. And she threw me out of there, and I was a minor, and it's like I would tell her, I said, this is illegal. And she would tell me, it don't matter, you're a criminal anyway.
Yeah.
And I got out of there, and I went and lived with my real friends. My mother don't like me. You know. And I came here so angry at my mother. My mom, you know, she tried the best she could with what she had to work with, see? And I didn't know that, you know. And I remember going and living over there with my friends, and a funny thing happened. They got tired of me, too. They started sounding like my mother. They did. They started saying some of the same things. You're going to stay here all day? You're going to lay here all day, right? And I remember just being rejected by those people. The nerve of them. You know, to not allow me to live worse than they were living in their presence. And so what happened is I got thrown out of there, and I decided, after being attacked by two of my friends in Watts for stealing money and lying and being full of crap, and they chased me down the street one day and attacked me and beat me up, and I ran to this little building called the Westminster Foundation, which is like a public type arts program, community outreach program in Watts. And I had been going there as a child doing theater work and, you know, kind of like the Little Rascals on crack kind of thing. And we drank and got loaded, and I remember being chased down there by my friends, and they beat me up, and I fell down on the ground, and the director of the program came out, you know, and she said, what happened to you? You know, and I couldn't answer her, you know, and they scraped me up and took me to Big General Hospital, Martin Luther King General Hospital. I get those county facilities mixed up. A lot of similarities. And they took me down there and they patched me up and they gave me Demerol, and I just, you know, drugs, you know, and so I went and got a drink, you know, and I remember drinking, and I went over to my brother's house. He had been letting me live there, and he had thrown me out, and so I went, and I was sleeping in his garage stall above his parking space in the apartment complex. And I remember going back over there, and I was so disconnected from the way I wanted this to work out. That had even started bothering me psychologically. You know. Dreams and the ideas of how I really wanted it to be. Whenever I would have those thoughts, that would just make me want to drink more. You know, because I knew that I was living unlike the thoughts that I had about living before I had to start living like that. That's what makes it different if you're new. And so what happens is I start seeing him leave in the morning, you know, and I could peek out, you know, you peek out the little thing, you open the little door, and you can see him driving off. And my brother is a federal corrections guard and or marshal for the federal government. He works at the federal prison downtown L.A. He's been over there for over 18 years. And he left me a note one day because I would break into his apartment to eat. And he left me a very loving sort of special note one day. And he told me that if I ever broke into his apartment again, that he was going to kill me. And those were his exact words. And instead of going, Jesus, this guy must be really angry, I thought to myself, damn, I could probably sue him for this because he works for the federal government and he's threatening my life. I have it here, proof that he is trying, you know, that he's going to kill my ass, you know. And I went ahead and warmed up some food and ate it and got the hell out of there, you know. And I remember just having him, he's so upset with me, you know, because he has really nice clothing, too, and I would take his clothes and sell them to get what I needed. And he couldn't keep me out of there because he put me on the lease. He was going to save me. And he had the frothy emotional appeal, you know, and it didn't work out. And I remember going and before he had gotten so exhausted with me, he had one day he was watching the Laker game, and he left his wallet on the counter. He had a $50 bill and a $20 bill in there. And I went in there, and I saw the wallet on the counter, and I saw him watching the game. And I said, you know, and I looked in there, and I saw, I said, you know, that's a $50 bill, and there's a $20 bill right there. I see it. So I said, you know, I'm not going to rip my brother off. I'm not going to do that. That's not, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll be an honest thief, and I'll just take the 20. Leave the 50 there, because he needs it. You know, he's got bills to pay. And then I went back, took the 20, left, came back. And so, you know, I mean, he does have a pretty good job. And rationalized that and took the 20. And then I came back, and I was standing out in front of the apartment of where he lived. And I was standing across the street from the apartment, and I just started bawling. Because I knew at that point that I had become a bum. You guys call it alcoholic all you want. I call it being a fucking bum. And I remember standing there and I started crying. And I didn't know what to do. And so I took my form of alcohol for me. And I reached way back as far as I could. Because I had had enough of my shit. And I took it, and I reached way, way back, you know, and I just threw it. Because it was over for me. However, I did kind of watch where it landed. I knew that reality may set in. Somebody may talk some shit to me. Somebody may tell me something I don't want to hear. They ask me to do something I don't want to do. And I might have to go back to my resources. But that didn't work. Eventually what happened is I got chased into a place called Warm Springs Rehabilitation Center, which is described as an asylum in this book. And in that place, what they did is they brainwashed me. It changed the way I thought about drinking and stuff. And I don't really think they, you know, put me in a chair and drilled a hole in my head. But what they did is they just left an open menu of all the stuff that it takes to get guys and gals like us to really seriously look at Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and they sort of cattled us in there psychologically. You know, get in there, you know, get on in there, yeah. You know, with all of y'all, go into the meetings, and you go into the meetings, and you hear these people talking. The first meeting I ever went to was a candlelight meeting, it was dark, and you hear these people in there, and you don't really see anybody in the candlelight meeting at Warm Springs. It's dark up there. It was a Wednesday night, and I remember seeing these little faces like, come out of the dark, you know, because I was still detoxing, so it was like these little faces come out of the dark. Hi, I'm a bum too. And then go back in, and then somebody else would say something, and they, you know, and they were talking about not drinking, and why they couldn't drink anymore, and how many programs they had been into. You know, a lot of people in my first year, all I kept hearing was, I've done this, and this, and this, and now I'm back again. I came and I did this and then I did that and now I'm back again. And as a person who was in his first meeting for the first time, as an alcoholic, one of the symptoms of my disease is that I see people doing alcoholism with impunity. I automatically home in on that, regardless of what my sobriety date is. And I could hear in the message that they were telling what I wanted to hear, which is, you could leave here and get back. You know? And I didn't understand that. It took me about, you know, it took me about 2.5 months to realize that when they said that they were really leaving, it wasn't like they were leaving the meeting. They were leaving the program. They were leaving these people. And I would be like, why in the hell would you leave this place? All these free cigarettes and chips. Everybody gives you a cigarette here. I have not smoked a cigarette off the ground since I've been in AA. And then they had food. There was food there. Food that was not out of the trash can. Food that they would prepare in the kitchen. And people were talking about leaving here forever. You know, what I'm trying to say is my entry into AA was like going to Disneyland. I loved it. I loved it. This stuff is like kissing a baby's ass compared to where I really come from. But I hear people now just being stuck at the beginning, complaining about the process, and looking for a complaint box as soon as possible. And I don't understand that. That's not my experience with you people. At any rate, I just got involved at that place, whatever I could do. They voted me in as the AA committee, steering committee chairman, and I didn't take the steps. You don't take the steps in there, you take the packets. You take the step packet and go and fill it out, and you turn it in, and then you get a star. And I like that. You don't get to move closer to God, but you do get to feel like you're running something, you know. And I love that. I was like, yeah, you know. And then they made a mistake and gave me a position. They let me become the assistant director of the LIP, Literacy Improvement Program, where I taught these classes. So here I am with no high school diploma, I'm in rehab, and I'm teaching classes. I taught 4 classes. I taught a speech class, I taught a current event class, I taught a music appreciation class, and then I ran the LIP testing part that the residents had to take when they came into the facility while I was there. I did all of that shit. Somebody had to do it. Why not the high school dropout? And sit down, and I remember, it's a 90-day program, but I stayed there for 11 months because they needed me, you know. Like breaking into the asylum, you know. And eventually, my counselor, Chuck von Nordheim, he had a meeting with me, and he said, DeAndre, I knew something was wrong. I don't know what had happened, but he called me and said, DeAndre, you have got to leave here. Warm springs, you know. And I said, well, what are you talking about? I'm doing recovery here. You know? I see all the other people, the other long-term residents, everybody says, DeAndre, you've been here for almost a year. And automatically I assume, well, you know what? There's got to be a racial problem here. I'm black, and see, I'm a black person, and y'all trying to bring a brother down. And he said, yeah, we're trying to bring you down from this damn hill. You got to get out of here, you know. Long Springs was up in the mountains. And so I left there. I left there and I moved to Lancaster, California. You know, Lancaster. And I went to a place called the Open Door Fellowship Hall of Alcoholics Anonymous. And those people saved my life. And I met a man named Dennis Lee. And he was evil and big and white and wrong. And he had a wife that looked like a parrot. Yeah. And first time I saw her, I looked at her and I said, this lady looks like a parrot. And then they took me over, to their house to feed me breakfast, and I walked past the kitchen and I looked in the living room, and there was a whole cage full of like 3 or 4 parrots. We got the white guys from Florida and the parrot lady living together. And he's going to help me. How is this man going to help me if he is married to a woman who looks like a bird? Because I know people around here have a checklist for assistance. And then if you meet that list, then they'll go ahead and ask you for the right amount of help they need. We have the teaching as well. When they don't let AA be the last house on the block. This is the first house on the block for a lot of people. You know? And I don't understand why I got stuck with this guy. I saw my friends leaving the meeting with their sponsors, riding off, you know, looking up, you know, they'd be laughing and shit. And I'm here with this guy. The man that's married to the parent lady. And he is telling me about real life. And he's convincing me that I need to take these steps because real life is coming. And I don't want to deal with real life because I see people in AA avoiding that with impunity. It doesn't seem like it hurts them when they don't do their work. Or when they sleep with anything that's got a hole in it. It doesn't seem like anything is affecting these people who are not following the kind of direction that this man is trying to give me. And that's frustrating. And I had a problem with him telling me that there was something spiritual about having the job. And I did not see that in the big book. Nowhere in this book does it say it's not spiritual about having a job. I looked diligently for it. It ain't in there. But what happened was, I just believed that he knew what he was talking about because my feelings and the way I looked at stuff had gotten me to AA. So if this guy knew how to stay sober, he had 5 years at the time. If he knew how to stay sober for 5 years, you know, and my counselor had to beg me to leave the rehab to deal with life, then maybe I ought to take some direction from this guy. And I didn't do it because I felt like I was being noble or anything. I did it because it didn't feel like I had any other alternative. And basically what happened is he made me read with him. He would make me define words out of the book, and he would show me the steps that he took. You know, and then he asked me to do this stuff. And these little, they call them exercises over in West LA, but these little things that he asked me to do seemed to kind of pull life together for me. And it allowed me to be functional and Alcoholics Anonymous. In other words, it wasn't like a jack-in-the-box experience. I didn't just drive up to him, he'd load up my car in my head with all this bullshit, and I'd just drive off and go, live my life. That's not the way he presented it to me. He gave me an opportunity to do both. You know, if I cared to have it. And of course I did, because I was hopeless. You know, it wasn't because I was trying to be the best of the best. Sure. You know, through working the steps with him, he taught me how to get involved with that group. And he also put me in his sober living home. And I lived there for 2.5 years. He made me the manager of his sober living home. And one day, the washing machine broke at the sober living home. And I came home from school, and water was all over the floor of the sober living home. And I had warned him, I told him, that washing machine, you talked about a guy that used to live on Skid Row, okay? Now I'm in the house complaining about the washing machine. I forget where I come from a lot. Part of my mental illness. I know everybody in here has a dynamic memory and don't understand it. But I come home and there's water all over the floor, and I called him on the telephone, and I said, there's water all over the place here. We are trying to live in this environment, and as a slumlord, you are ruining that for us by not taking care of this situation. And he said, I can't do anything about it right now. Let me get somebody over there. And I said, no, I'm coming over there. And I hopped in my 71 El Camino that he took me to go buy when I got the money to go get it. And I drove over to his house. You know. And the parent lady was not there. But he was. And I let him have it. And I told him, enough is enough. Now, you've been sponsoring me for well over a year. I'm bathing regularly. I have this automobile here. I'm doing better now. So let me tell you how you're going to help me even more, damn it. I don't know if anybody in here can relate to that kind of behavior. And he yelled at me and told me to get the hell out of his house. And I told him, not only am I going to get out of your house, but I need to find another sponsor. And I called Steve Gridkin, who is the Jimmy Moss of the Open Door at the time. And I drove over and I met the great Steve Gridkin, and he told me that you said in those steps that you were willing to go through any length for victory over alcohol, and that may include your sponsor's personality. And I looked at this one and I said, so all the white people are band together now.
In AA.
And I went home. I went to my sponsor's property and I began to clean the water out because the newcomers were there doing it anyway already. The new people that we had moved into the house. They were over there doing the work. And I was running around protesting. That's how I roll. And then all of a sudden, I turned into the supervisor. Well, we are going to clean this shit up. You two move that over there and do that, you know. After I done went and cussed the landowner out. I'm a real alcoholic, you know. Anyway, I made amends to him, and I sucked up to him because I realized I didn't have enough money to move out. And all of a sudden, I came to my senses. Did that come from me? Everybody down the floor! I mean, if we're going to do this hostage situation right, it's got to come from me. I'm not going to learn anything from you. Because I know what's best for me. And when I start living like that and operating like that, even without a drink in my hand, I could become a very thirsty man. When you're not allowed to show me exactly what I need to see based on who God needs you to be, I'm asking for alcohol. I need a drink. See? And what happened was that relationship grew even stronger. You know? Because he realized that I was out of my mind. 12 and 12 on the last page of step one talks about the kinds of guys and gals that really can't dream of doing this stuff. Talks about the man or woman that's still drinking. They can't dream of doing this stuff. So it's like, as a newer person in the program or somebody that's on a dry drunk, when I can't even dream of taking inventory or making those amends, paying back that money, saying these prayers, trying to live as though I think my God would have me, but I'm not willing to do that stuff. I am in the mind of a man that's still drinking. Watch it. See? That the psychic change is flipping back. You know, my big book tells me something about improvement.
I used to think that the 11th step said maintain. And they have an example in the book on a guy that wasn't improving in his spiritual life. He was agreeing with AA, but he wasn't improving in the spiritual walk toward his Creator. And he got drunk again behind that. You know, and Ethan was talking earlier about some of our friends who've gone back out. We bring this up not as some sort of a scare tactic. We're allowed to learn from other people's experiences today. Psychopathic people don't do that. And our friend was doing good on the outside. There wasn't a cloud on the horizon. He had no idea he was going to leave. Because knowing us, we would have probably tried to help him. Some people call it control. Man, I wish the hell I did have that, you know, control. Because he'd be here in this meeting. He'd be giving Ethan that cake. I don't think it's control at all. I think we become attracted to certain things in AA, man, as long as we stay around here. You know, water seeks its own level. And if you don't want what we have, that's fine. We don't want what the hell you got either. We're trying to get rid of it. That's what he used to tell us. You know? And what happens is, it's like, I move out of these situations, and then I move into another situation, and it's sort of like peeling the layer of an onion, where I think that, oh, I'm done with pride and ego. I don't have any fear. I'm here for the newcomer. I'm not afraid of anything. And then God put somebody in my life and proves to me that not only am I afraid of something, but I've been lying about it the whole time. See, my higher power works through people most of the time because I'm a people. If I was a dog, he'd probably be working through dogs. I am a people, and my higher power puts people in my life so I can realize that it's not about me, that it's about us. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of all my troubles. That's a very heavy statement to use on people like us. You know how sensitive we are. We're sensitive people. How dare you tell me that no matter what I'm dealing with, in the middle of it is me, like that little man on The Wizard of Oz, talking about pay no attention to the, you know, the man behind the curtain. You know, I am the wizard, you know. All this bullshit, right? And I'm the one trying to get that drink. You got to line the alcohol up. You got to line it up. And what happened is he just loved me until I could love AA. He never waited around for me to learn how to love myself. He was too busy helping too many new people. He just loved me until I could love AA. And when I started loving AA, I fell in love with him. That's because he's a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a newcomer, I don't expect you to love us. The sign on the podium says, we care. It doesn't say, you care. We know you don't care. You probably would rather have a drink right about now. Just after this pitch. That's why I got all this water up here. You know. It's a little frustrating sometimes. Sober. Being sober. Yay! Sobriety. That's what it felt like when I was new. When I'd go to the meetings and I'd hear them, yes, sobriety! All right! You know, I'd be like, what is so funny about not being able to even smoke a joint? I mean, I know the alcohol, it makes you smell bad, vodka, you know, but you can't have a little homegrown every now and then? They mean total abstinence. A day at a time. These people are crazy. I was sharing the other night, it would be neat if you could, like, because my friend Max Bernstein says that if you look at the steps as an equation, it seems like the answer would be, okay, go ahead and drink now. I mean, you've done all this work. You've rearranged your life. You're closer to God than you ever. I mean, Jesus drank wine. You know, my head automatically tries to set me up for a drink, even after the psychic change. It's my job to just cop to that and continue to stay connected to you people and stop trying to run game. I mean, it's like this gal shares at Kirk Street, you bring the weakest game to the strongest player. Alcoholics Anonymous, man, there's so much love and there's legions of people here who have the experience. We know what you're up to when you don't think you're doing what you do. That man read two sentences into my book. I couldn't even talk over a paragraph. And he just cut it in. I don't like it while it's happening. But after time passed, I go, you know, what would I would have died. Alcoholism would have killed me. If those people didn't do exactly what they did when they did it, I would be a dead man. You know, and a lot of times I think people in AA get death confused. For me, death is a state of mind and body. You could be sitting next to a dead person right now and miss me. The way AA looks at it. Spiritually bankrupt, dead. Talking about, you know, in step 5 and the 12 and 12, you know, I accuse my very best AA friends of the very defects that I'm living in when I'm dry. Trying to find a drink up in here, you know. Looking for a drink in Alcoholics Anonymous, man, comes in many forms for me. But I try to play like it's something else. You know, and so what helps me is just not trying to be God. And boy, that's really hard. I mean, God spends absolutely no time trying to be me. But I be trying to fill his shoes all the time, you know. And it's a scary place to be, you know. Here lately, I've been trying to deal with my health in a more responsible way. I found out a week ago that I had the best vision insurance that you can buy, you know, and I didn't even know. I've had it for over 4 years from my job. And I've just been walking around not being able to read very clearly when words are too close to my face and I don't say anything about it. And I went and talked to this lady who runs the doctor's office for one of my clients, and she ran my name and she said, you know, it's only a cost of $35 to give an examination. They check out if you've got glaucoma, and they give you a pair of glasses. And I thought to myself, gee, it's a good thing I decided to come on down here. See, it has to, my ego says that it's got to come from me. If it's not coming from me, it's a little screwy. And that's alcoholism. That's not rational thinking. My 12 and 12 and step 2 tells me how being irrational is directly linked to insanity and dishonesty. I didn't know that. This irrational, like, yeah, all of a sudden all these people in AA are messing with me. 16 years sober, they finally are going to pull the thing down, you know. Now we'll make a drink. Yeah. Because I don't want to change with time sober. I don't want to change with time sober. I want to maintain. I don't want to improve. And say, how can you sponsor all these people? Because you're not. That's not fun. Join us. You know, it's like, I was thinking on the way over here today that my life is not my life, that it belongs to God. And I screw up trying to do what he would have me regularly. So instead of giving up and drifting into Mosul and guilt and blaming you people, I just wake up and keep trying. You know, it keeps dying on the installment plan. So if you're a newcomer, we know that you are totally confused by all this stuff. That's why we give you these certain little activities to do, regardless of what the hell you think needs to get done. And the guys and gals who don't successfully go through that process usually do not get to stay here. And I don't care what kind of story, feeling, situation, or spin they put on it. You're either in or you're out. The opposite of in is always out, no matter who you are or what you think it's all about. If you're not in, you're out. And I would always try to put things in front of me to deny. You know, I've always had a problem with reality. I've always struggled with things that are real. And I don't think it's because I wake up and try to do that. I think I'm mentally, my sponsor says that this is a mental illness. And I need treatment. Let me share a little bit about my mom, and I'm going to shut up. I know everybody's dying to get out of here and work this program. Alcoholics are very busy improving their lives, making things better for themselves. Kind of like the way we used to push those baskets around on Skid Row, going around collecting stuff. People in AA are good at that. My mother is, she's 18% for kidney. She only has 18, so they had to put her on dialysis. So she goes to dialysis 3 times a week. She hates it on most days. She can't stand it. And in the beginning, before she would go, she said she wasn't going to go, and I called her and I sponsored her ass. Because everybody else was like, that's a mom, you know, and I didn't go for it. You men and women taught me about reality. I just told her straight out, if you want to see your grandkids a little longer, you might want to go on down there and do it. Or, as my sponsor says, maybe you like it like that. And she got pissed off. She gossiped about it in the family. She told everybody I pissed her off. But that Monday, she went down and got it all set up. Hate me now, stay alive longer. Later. Hate me now, stay alive longer later. You know, and so now she goes on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And I don't know if anybody is familiar with the process, but it's really tedious, and it takes a couple of hours each time that you have to go do it. And she's really exhausted and all that, but she thanked me for telling her the truth later. So if you're working with new people and they're not thanking you today, so what? They call newcomers pigeons back east. Because they shit on you. And if you're not being thanked by the newcomer, it doesn't mean that you don't help the newcomer. You know? The newcomers don't know how to thank nobody. Newcomers are probably sitting around like me thinking that they came up with all this shit. But this was their idea to come here. When people, what is that thing they used to say? My best thinking got me here. Nowhere in that book does it say your best thinking is going to get you here. What got me here was the grace of God. What keeps me here is the willingness of the people that aren't afraid to tell me the truth. People who are willing to take a risk on losing me as a friend so I don't go back out there again. Because learning how to say goodbye around here is really difficult. But a lot of times I have to do that because my disease hones in on what you're doing with impunity, and the next thing you know, we're sharing alcohol together. You know, we go out together. I've seen guys and gals go out together. You know, as an individual here, I need to know that I need you people. I have to be connected to this stuff. And my mother is just one of those people that I laugh and talk to. My grandmother died this year. My sponsee family walked me through that. And we went over to my grandmother's house, and they waited outside and in the truck. And it was crowded in the truck. It was like 6 guys. And they waited for me to go in there. My grandma, I don't have friends like this in the community when I'm out there getting drunk and stuff. When I went to the hospital and Marcella took me to the emergency room, was bleeding to death. You know, my real family got there after you guys took care of everything. And I forget that. And I know if I'm forgetting it, I know you do too. Because we're very much alike. So I'm just really grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous has not turned its back on me. And the only way that I can repay that debt is to pray to God that I don't wind up turning my back on you. If you're a newcomer, hang in there. It gets a little salty sometimes. So you better take a little piece of this meeting with you. You know, life is good today. I got a good life. I'm going to read one thing out of the book and then I'm going to go down off the podium. As you can see, my outfit matches the book today. That's the kind of shit you got to look forward to when you get 16 years of sobriety. You start looking like the big book. You look like the big book. I got 1 minute left, okay? And I'm going to read a part in the book that really doesn't make me comfortable. It says, as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action, not the right opinion poll, but the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show. Humbly saying to ourselves, not everybody else, humbly saying to ourselves, many times each day, thy will be done. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, and foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. I'm really grateful to be here, and that's my time. Thanks.